Hello and welcome to another Stop Hitting Yourself episode of Dave Wright's podcast. I'm your host, Dave Wright. Each week here, I like to share the next chapter from my novel, Soul. As always, at the end of the episode, I will talk a bit about the chapter, where it came from, how it came together, or anything that comes to mind. So if you're interested, then stick around at the end. For now, let's get into it. This week is chapter 21. Fighting myself. Six years ago. I have been spending more and more time wandering through the city and away from the temple. Ever since I'd gained these newfound powers, now that I'd become the thing I'd hated for so long, I struggled to understand where I fit. I had gained a super, to become a prime, because I'd finally accepted that I was not a copy, that I was my own man. Now I'd become an even more perfect replication. Just what did that mean? No longer afraid to head into the city, I didn't care if I saw another Levi. Finally secure in the knowledge of who I was. The words of a man that I had created and spoken with had become the mantra to my life now.
Remember who we want to be. You owe me that.
I still had no idea who that was. There was a hole in my mind that I didn't know how to fill. I desperately missed Valkyr. I wanted to talk with him, to see him smile at me again. This responsibility was mine alone. It was lonely in a way I had never felt before. I turned aimlessly down another alleyway. This area of town was still clean, but run down. People here were obviously trying their best to keep up appearances, but there's only so many times you can clean something before it becomes worn. That is what this part of the town was. Worn. The houses, the roads, the people. Beaten down by the organized crime that had moved in, beaten down by their own pride. A man shuffled by, pushing his cart of old shoes and slippers, calling his sales more out of habit than expecting anyone to buy. An older lady moved the plastic boxes full of food around in the stand out the front of her shop. Not that many people could afford the extravagance of eating store-bought food, but this was her job, probably her parents' business as well. There was no way she was going to give up. Her eyes said otherwise when she met mine. I turned away. I didn't want to give her false hope. A foreigner in this area might have some money, might be interested in buying something and letting her go home tonight with a bit of dignity. My almost empty pockets burned. So did my soul. The supers should have changed the world for the better. When it first happened, when the roulette of life finished spinning and started to bestow powers on random people, it was heralded as a new dawn for humanity. This would change things. It was no longer money, family, or connections that allowed you to rise to the top. It was random. Now was the time for Paul Stokes, the trucker who had busted his ass his whole life to provide a meager life for his family, who had spent his life on the road, barely seeing his family yet still making it work. He who could now hear everything other people thought. It was a gift, a miracle. He hung himself 2 weeks later. Now was the time for Daquan Miserly, self-proclaimed hood rat and proud of it, who was now unstoppable, literally. He was invulnerable and could walk through anything. No jail could hold him, no vault was safe. He brought his crew along with him and gained incalculable wealth. Now he's a paranoid lunatic. Everyone he worked with is dead as he was the only one with powers. Trapped, alone in a luxury apartment back in Arcadia. He doesn't trust anyone and does nothing with his money. People learned quickly that just because you got powers that was not a blessing or a curse, it just was. People are people. Mostly, people are bastards. Some of the most famous supers took over cities and ruled them like kings. Others are more vigilante-like, stopping crime and other supers, but leaving the city to run itself. Most, though, life went on. The world adjusted. I had changed so much in the last 3 years. The man who I was at creation was so different to who I was now. Being created thinking that supers were doing the right thing and were the natural leaders of the world. Not having the power myself had quickly shown how fucking self-centered and disgusting that thinking was. Levi Prime only thought that way because he was a super. After living without, after seeing the world as the terrifying place where it seemed to bend and break at the whims of psychos with reality-altering strength, and there was not one good goddamn thing I could do to stop it, where the supers were more concerned with their own power and status than helping humanity. Supers had become the nouveau riche, except there was no guillotine strong enough to stop them this time. A burst of sound and stale cigarette smoke from the pachinko parlor brought me back to reality. Looking around, I had no idea where I was. The smell of the cigarettes faded with my thoughts. Still not sure who I wanted to become or what to do about being a super. I need to make sure I understood who I really was before seeing Valkyr again. There was no way I could go back to Arcadia when I would now be whining about something new. The ghostly words of the other me before being absorbed were still stuck in my brain, stopping me from celebrating this new change. My eyes focused on a man up ahead, clothes as faded and old as he was, wiping his forehead with a white cloth before tying it around his head. I slowed down to watch him bend over a small beer barrel, and with a grunt of effort, lifted off the path and carried inside his little restaurant. There'd been no moment of realization of a bolt out of the blue, but I could feel my thoughts shuffling around. Maybe it was not about changing the whole world. There was no way I could make everyone's life perfect, of taking the pain of existence away for everyone. But I could help who was in front of me. I could make life just a little better here and there. Maybe that is who I wanted to be. Maybe that was enough. Striding over to the collection of kegs, I waited until the old timer reappeared and said in my schoolboy Japanese, "Please, let me help you." Ignoring the usual social please that was unnecessary, I lifted one of the barrels with ease and carried it into the darkness. That is how I found myself seated at the dented and scarred wooden counter of Hiro-san's restaurant with cold drink in hand. Hiro-san had just shrugged when I said no to the offered beer, instead pouring a barley tea from his own battered jug. Once I'd helped carry the barrels in, another delivery was made of some sad-looking pork and bundles of wilted sprouts, which I also brought behind the bar. Not without him telling me it was not needed every step of the way. Jingling the coins in my pocket, I had enough to pay for a meal. I knew that Hiro-san would not accept payment, so I planned on just leaving them on the counter when I left. Sipping on the cold tea, I watched Hiro-san potter around the stove. He had the practice movement of decades. He was slow and methodical, but there was no wasted effort or energy. I realized I was watching a master craftsman, someone who back in Arcadia would have a line around the block of young people waiting to get in, of trying the new hotness and going on about finding a hidden gem. Here, he was a forgotten footnote of history, scraping out a living. In that moment, I was ashamed, deeply, uncontrollably ashamed, of who I was, of how I'd been drinking myself to death and running from my own problems. I had lived my life so concerned with myself that I had ignored everything around me. Of how I had treated the people around me and hurt them over and over.
"Remember who we wanted to be. You owe me that."
I caught my thoughts in a spiral. I could make new choices. The door slid open. I turned to see two men attempt to swagger in, but the restaurant is so small they were forced to stop and awkwardly sidle past the chairs, calling out for Hiro-san. They barely gave me a glance. Apparently foreigners were invisible to them. Hiro-san appeared behind the counter and looked shocked before being able to cover the expression. He invited the men to the back of the restaurant and headed down there. They followed, talking loudly about the state of the place. I'm not fluent in Japanese, but understood enough to follow the conversation. Enough to know that the two men asked Hiro-san if I understood Japanese, and heard it when Hiro-san lied. I tried to not be too obvious about watching as I sipped on my tea, but I heard them. I heard them threaten Hiro-san and demand their protection payment early. I heard Hiro-san beg for time, for clemency. I heard them laugh. In that moment, I knew I would kill them. I didn't consciously think that. I thought I would follow them out and try and get Hiro-san's money back, to get them to stop. But in my heart, I knew I would kill them. All my scattered thoughts were coming together, of not being able to change the world, of not being able to be who I wanted, of seeing the way the Supers got away with anything they wanted, and ignored the crime happening under their noses because it didn't touch them. Of this neighborhood barely existing, yet the people here were still carving out a life, and these two fucks showed up to beat this man down, again and again. Of Hiro-san not giving up, of following what he wanted, and being who he saw himself as, even as they tried to cut him down. Quietly slipping the coins to pay for the tea onto the counter, I got up and left. I waited outside, mind roiling, not even trying to hide as there was no point. I'm the only foreigner in a 6-block radius. I didn't even know how I was going to get the money back, but I didn't have the space in my mind to even worry about that. These men were going to pay. The wooden door slid open, and they stepped out.
"Hey, dickholes!"
I called out in English without thinking. They turned with questioning looks on their faces. "What do you want?" they responded in Japanese. It took a moment for me to understand what they'd said and to figure out how to respond.
"I want you to give me what you stole and to never come back,"
I said in Japanese, my hands relaxed and now loose by my side. This was the right thing. I felt calm, my mind clearing, almost as if I was floating. A small voice whispered in my mind, "Be who we want to be." The laneway we were standing in was deserted, most of the shops shuttered and closed, the smell of frying meats reaching up to me, carried by the soft breeze. The two men looked at each other and then back to the crazy foreigner.
"We stole nothing. We have a business agreement with the old man. Who are you to question this?"
I saw them rest their hands inside their coats. Guns were not easy to get a hold of around here, so they were probably reaching for their knives. That should have been scary, should have been the wake-up call that what I was doing was insane. It's not like I was a fighter or even if I was armed. Still floating on the shifting of my worldview, nothing was going to stop me now. This was the right thing to do. This is who I wanted to be. I would not stand by anymore. I slid a foot forward, raising one hand palm up towards the men while slowly twisting to the right. The basic forms I'd been taught by Sensei as a meditation device coming easy to my body. The men followed the rising palm with their eyes, so when I snapped forward with my other fist, they didn't even see it coming, driving it forward with my whole body, rotating my hips to try and punch my way through the man's midsection. With an explosive grunt and cry, he stumbled backwards and fell. I tried to recover my balance. My body was not used to this, my legs were still too short in my mind. The second man had drawn his wicked-looking knife, but didn't strike.
"You idiot!"
I said. No, I didn't say that. He said it. I said it. My duplicate said it. There was a second me standing there now. The blow, the kinetic force of the punch. Of course, I was a super now. I had created another copy. I had done what I had promised myself, literally what I would never do. I stared at me. Me stared at I. The two of us stared at each other, incredulity painting our faces as a realization of what he, I, we had done hit us. I was so distracted I barely saw the knife flickering towards me. I did see it, but not for long as I tried to flinch out of the way. That was the only reason the tip sunk into my left eye and not all the way through into my brain. Pain burst like firecrackers in my mind. The world went black and red in alternating shades. The agony was unbearable. I went down. I tried to scream, to curse in pain and terror, but I couldn't. Unable to do anything but writhe on the ground, crying in great gasping globs of spit and sound. My eye, my face, our eye. We were three. Our hands were slick with blood and spit, clutching our ruined sockets. Our other eye was glued shut in sympathy. The world ignored around us as we scrabbled on the ground like drowning rats. I mimicked me, he mimicked me, the new me, my duplicate, joining me, writhing on the ground, screaming in agony, shattering the wet blanket of despair that usually covered this laneway. The untouched Yudai, the me created before they took my sight, took advantage of the shock of the man with the knife and fell upon him like a caged beast set free. Seeing your own face getting punctured, hearing the wet slurping sound of your eye collapsing under a knife is not something many men get to hear secondhand. It was enough that he fell upon the knife wielder with a rage and beat him to the ground, swinging his, my, fists again and again. The red rage filled our mind, his mind. We didn't even notice when he had stopped striking with his fists and just clutched the man's head and slammed it against the cobbled street, screaming incoherently, again and again and again. It was over in seconds. The first gangster recovered enough to struggle upright and tried to take in the insanity. His friend's head was a mess on the ground, smeared by the man who had punched him, or not him, by me, by him, by us. Two copies of that man were crying out on the ground, clutching their ruined faces and bleeding everywhere in almost perfect unison. The gangster did the only sane thing he could. He ran. Slowly, this little nightmare scene calmed down. The Yudai on the man's chest came to. The mound of flesh and blood that he was holding was no longer a head. It swam back into his vision, and he released it. Slowly, very slowly, he turned to the side and began throwing up the tea we'd just had all over the cobbles, mixing with the mess already on the ground. I, me, the Prime, managed to gather himself, myself, enough to realize what was going on and tried to concentrate. I tried to push through the pain. He felt hollow inside and tried to fill that void. The two copies begun to shake and shimmer and snapped out of existence. I, Yudai, was left alone, crying and rocking back and forth on the ground. The memories of the two copies and what they had done and been through added into the horror of what we had just experienced. I got to experience it all again in stereo. It was too much. I dragged myself upright. I avoided looking at the red smear that was all that was left of the man on the ground and stumbled out of the laneway and down some alleys. The pain in my body and soul was enough to keep me going, twisting and turning through the back alleys. It was a long way back to the temple that night. That was chapter 21, Fighting Myself. This chapter has the most confusing fight scene I have written so far. It was heaps of fun to play out in my mind, but trying to get across what was happening was a challenge. Before I get into that though, I want to talk about the beginning for a bit. It's been a year since the last Seeker scene, and making the decisions of when to time skip or not was hard. I didn't want to speed run his storyline, but I also didn't want to get bogged down in the minutiae of his growth in the temple. Him processing what has happened and what he wants to happen is a long drawn out thing. Just like in reality, people don't have a single defining moment and then bam, their whole life is now ready and on a new track. It's a series of efforts, of tiny decisions again and again that make real change. Not to go on about ADHD again, but there's a great cartoonist slash author, Ali Brush. In it, she has one cartoon that I think perfectly sums up the ADHD slash depression thought process. Of that one day, you get the motivation from somewhere to do all the things you've been putting off. Washing your clothes, cleaning your house, whatever. And then you're like, sweet, I have now earned the trophy of being an adult. Except it's not like that. It's a constant process of doing things, of making decisions. You cannot brute force your way through it, and that sucks. So for the Seeker, I wanted to give him time to breathe and touch back on it when another event happens, not simply show him living. The section of the city that he's in for this chapter was drawn from one of my trips to Japan a long time ago. It's an area in Osaka called Shinsekai, which translates roughly as New World. When I was there, it was one of the poorest neighborhoods in all of Japan. It was run down and had a kind of gallows humor, being called the New World while being so old and destitute. All the shops and stalls were barely scraping by, but the place was still very clean and vendors were still trying their best. So every time I returned to Osaka, I would always make it a point to go to Shinsekai and spend my money there. Then something happened. It was a slow change, but the place finally seemed to be getting government attention and some redevelopments were going ahead. And now, last time I went there, it was full of tourists, brand new business everywhere. It was lovely to see, but I tried to not think about how a lot of the old stores were probably being priced out of the area. The ramen shop owner was based on the hundreds of places that I've been to that are not in the main city centers of Japan. If anyone tells you, you have to go here, this is the best ramen, tonkotsu, okonomiyaki, whatever, in all of Japan, you can safely ignore that. There is no best. The standard is so high that any random place you find will usually be amazing. The owners haven't honed their craft, so they work without expending unnecessary effort. Partly due to the fact that running any sort of service industry in Japan is incredibly tough. Long hours, low pay, people don't get into serving food to make money there. As to the Seeker then deciding that he would kill those two men, when I was planning this chapter, I thought there'd be a confrontation. But as I was writing it and trying to exist as the Seeker, it changed to death. There was no reasoning with them. The Seeker had made his choice. Of course, he had not thought it through, had not seen that him hitting someone would make a copy. I love the Seeker, but he is not a smart man in many ways. He is trying to change, but does not know exactly how or into what. But he has seen enough of the world from the bottom of a bottle and from someone's boot that his answers are direct. Not good, but direct. Well, that's all for this week. Don't forget, I have a Patreon up if you want to throw some support my way. You can find the details on my website, davewrights.com. That's Dave, WRIGHTS.com. Hopefully I'll see you all next week. Take care.